Today is Wednesday, September 16th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, conditions are dire for survivors of the fire in Greece's Moria refugee camp.
What these people want and need is to be moved off this island. They don't need a new tent. They need to be put into a proper, safe accommodation on the mainland of Greece or in other European countries.
Also ahead, rocket fire in the Middle East after Israel signs agreements to establish relations with Bahrain and the UAE. Plus, Japan has a new prime minister. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Over the night, militants launched rockets from Gaza into Israel and Israeli aircraft hit targets in Gaza. No deaths were reported on either side, but it was an explosive backdrop to the signing of treaties for formal ties between Israel and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates. Palestinians who seek an independent state view the U.S.-brokered deals as a betrayal of their cause. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He says, quote, "I'm not surprised that the Palestinian terrorists fired at Israel precisely during this historic ceremony," end quote. Netanyahu said they want to turn back the peace but will not succeed. Hazen Qassim, spokesman for the Hamas militant group in Gaza, accused Israel of attacking Gaza during the signing of the normalization deal. He says the airstrikes, quote, "inflicted massive damage on civilians who were already suffering from a long blockade and the dangerous repercussions of the coronavirus," end quote. He said, quote, "bombing is met with bombing," end quote, and that Hamas, quote, "would not allow the occupation to continue its aggression without any direct and appropriate response at the same time," end quote. The deals signed at the White House Tuesday are the first normalization treaties between Israel and Arab nations in a quarter century. President Trump called the event, involving leaders from Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain, a historic breakthrough and the start of a regional transformation. But these agreements differ from Israel's earlier treaties with Egypt and Jordan, which ended decades of war. Neither the UAE nor Bahrain have ever gone to war with Israel. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi discussed what the normalization means with Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington.
Normalization, frankly, at this time in Arab history has become kind of in the eye of the beholder. It depends how you want to interpret it. With all due respect to the president of the United States, I do not think that this is a historical breakthrough in the sense that these countries have had ongoing relationship with Israel that goes back to quite a few years. That was normalization, including trade, including security cooperation, arms sales, and technology. And these countries never had a state of war with Israel. I mean, when was the last battle we have witnessed between the leader of the United Arab Emirates, whom Mr. Trump calls the Great Warrior, or the King of Bahrain and the State of Israel? So it's kind of more of a propaganda related to elections here, more of a propaganda related to the needs of Netanyahu with all his failure to deal with issues in his own country. And both of them seem to be manipulating the willingness of few Arab countries at this time to normalize without asking for serious things in return. I mean, the art of politics, if normalization is a political phenomena, is quid pro quo, giving and taking at the same time. And this seems to me to be a one-way street. In the past, it didn't work for others who did that, and they learned their lessons. But apparently, some of these countries that have never done it fully before seem to underestimate the lesson. They insist on repeating the same mistake.
Some analysts say the agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain cement an informal alliance against Iran and could pave the way for the United Arab Emirates to acquire advanced U.S. weapons, while leaving the far more contentious Israeli-Palestinian conflict as intractable as ever. Do you agree with such analysis?
Definitely, these steps that are being undertaken by countries like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain definitely part ways with other countries in the past where they committed to what was known as the Arab Peace Initiative for a collective policy vis-a-vis Israel. That is no longer the case. It negated that. So despite their declared intentions that they are doing this on behalf of the Palestinians or to help the Palestinian cause, I think their case is not very convincing. Otherwise, they would have coordinated these efforts with the Palestinian, whether it's the PLO or the Palestinian Authority or the Palestinian people in general. This is an attempt by the United States to form a new coalition or a new alliance in the region. And it is more than normal. So unfortunately, I don't think we're about to see peace all of a sudden spread throughout the region. I think this is a short-sighted attempt to do favors to each other in return for very narrow objectives, particularly arms sales, which have not in the past and will not in the future contribute to peace and stability in the region.
Would Saudi Arabia abandon its own initiative based on land for peace and join this drive for peace for peace?
The Saudis continue to insist that they are still abiding by the Arab Peace Initiative, which was essentially a Saudi initiative going back to 2002. However, when you have to factor in Saudi Arabia allowing Al Al flights to fly in Saudi space, plus giving green light to Bahrain to pursue this official alliance and agreement with Israel, it seems to me that there is a crack in the dam here. The Saudis are waiting for the right time, and they are around the corner. And the question is one of timing, not if they will recognize Israel and normalize with it.
That was Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington, speaking to my VOA colleague Mohammed El-Shanawi. There may be changes to the European Union's migration policy following last week's devastating fire in the Moria camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. The fire left thousands of refugees, migrants, and asylum seekers homeless. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the new immigration rules will be announced next week and urged all European countries to help solve migration challenges. Germany said it would take over 1,500 migrants who are now on Lesbos. Journalist Catherine Field in Paris has more.
The decision by the German government to take in more than 1,500 refugees from Greece comes after an initial pledge to take in 150 unaccompanied minors whose camp burned down on Lesbos. Preparations are now being made to welcome these migrants, mostly families with children who have already secured refugee status in Greece. The move to take in these refugees came after German Chancellor Merkel met with her coalition partners, and it was during that meeting she complained at the slowness with which Europe was responding to the need for resettlement schemes. Meanwhile, the European Council president told reporters during a visit to the remains of the Lesbos camp that the EU will help with construction of new facilities, but it is also working on revised policies on migration, which will be published later this month and will deal with securing Europe's external borders, action against human smugglers, and assuring that those whose right to settle in Europe is respected. Catherine Field for VOA News, Paris.
While European leaders try to reach a deal on migrant policy, the thousands of people displaced by the Moria fire are living in dire conditions, says Faris Al-Jawad, a spokesman for the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. He spoke to me from Lesbos today.
Currently, there are thousands of people sleeping on the streets without any real shelter, the vast majority without even a tent. It's baking hot. There is no regular food distribution. There is no regular or clear sanitary conditions for them to keep clean, to go to the toilet.
The United Nations says it's building hundreds of tents to house the people there. What do you make of this effort?
That's not really a long-term solution. What these people want and need, and MSF are advocating for as well, is to be moved off this island. They don't need a new tent. They need to be put into a proper, safe accommodation on the mainland of Greece or in other European countries. We know, because we've been here as MSF, Doctors Without Borders, for over 5 years, and keeping people contained in camps is simply a cruel policy that is extremely detrimental to people's medical and mental health.
And what are some of the medical and mental health conditions that you're seeing among the people?
There are many pregnant women who are needing attention. They need better food supplements. They need special food, obviously, because they're pregnant. We see many babies, many of whom are newborn, or at least in the last 10 days or so, who have skin rashes because there's nowhere for them to be cleaned. They are not eating properly. They are under the baking sun all day. Some of them have inhaled tear gas from the police, smoke from the fire. We see many, many old people who are having panic attacks. We see many people with severe mental health problems. They don't want to be put into another camp that is like Moria, because this was traumatizing them every day. From children, we were seeing cases of a spectrum, anything from nightmares and bedwetting to older children who were presenting with self-harm and even suicidal ideation.
Germany just announced it will take in over 1,500 people from Moria. What do you make of this decision?
It's a small step in the right direction. That 1,500 across all the islands, it's a bit of a drop in the ocean. But of course, I mean, these are the kind of things that need to be happening. And indeed, we need to see other European states follow suit, but not just with 20 to 50 or 70 people here and there. We're talking about just in Moria, there are 12,000 people, many of whom are vulnerable. So what we need to see is more states following in this lead. And we need to see that happen now.
That was Faris Al-Jawad, a spokesman for the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. This is VOA. A U.S. House of Representatives report says two deadly Boeing 737 MAX jet crashes were the result of multiple failures at Boeing Corporation and the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. All 737 MAX jets were grounded after the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 near Addis Ababa, which killed all 157 people aboard in March 2019. In October 2018, a Lion Air 737 MAX crashed in Indonesia, killing 189 people. Both crashes were linked to software to keep the jets from stalling. House Democrats of the Transportation Committee Wednesday released its report highlighting a number of failings. They include pressure within Boeing to rush the MAX into production, and what the committee said was Boeing's undue influence on Federal Aviation Administration regulators. The report is the result of an 18-month probe, and it comes as Boeing is working with the FAA to install upgrades that will let the 737 MAX fly again. The House report also calls for new legislation to tighten the U.S. aviation regulatory system. In 13 nations around the world, only 34% of those surveyed had favorable opinions of the United States, a new Pew Research Center survey shows. Pew said that 41% in the United Kingdom have a favorable opinion of the U.S., the lowest ranking for the U.K. in the survey's 20 years. And in Germany, the favorable rating is 26%, near a record low. Pew says two factors drove the decline: the U.S. handling of the coronavirus pandemic and attitudes toward U.S. President Donald Trump. A median of 15% of the respondents in the 13 countries thought the U.S. had done a good job in dealing with the pandemic, whereas 57% said the European Union had done a good job. Only 16% said they trusted President Trump to do the right thing. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was among the highest-ranked international leaders at 76%. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Japan's parliament has elected Yoshihide Suga as prime minister, replacing long-serving leader Shinzo Abe with his right-hand man. Keeping his usual straight face, Suga made several deep bows when the results were announced in parliament's lower house, where he has a seat. Suga, who was chief cabinet secretary and the top government spokesman under Abe, selected a cabinet that is a mix of fresh faces and current or former ministers. They hold their first meeting later Wednesday. He promises to serve the interests of ordinary people and rural communities. For more on Suga, here's AP's Charles de Ledesma.
Before he got Japan's top government job officially, Yoshihide Suga was known as a shadow prime minister and the right-hand man for his long-serving predecessor. When Shinzo Abe announced last month he would resign due to ill health, his chief cabinet secretary Suga said he would come forward to pursue Abe's unfinished work. Now the self-made politician is elected by parliament as Japan's new prime minister, 2 days after he succeeded Abe as leader of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. Suga's low-key image from government briefings contrasts with his behind-the-scenes work at managing bureaucrats and pushing policies. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A judicial inquiry in Australia continues to probe failures in the nation's COVID-19 hotel quarantine system for returning travelers. The inquiry has heard that security breaches almost certainly sparked a deadly second wave of infections in the state of Victoria. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Foreign nationals were banned from Australia when its international borders were closed in March. But many thousands of citizens and permanent residents have been allowed to fly home, where they face a mandatory 14 days in hotel quarantine. In Victoria, Australia's second most populous state, the system has been chaotic. Members of a judicial inquiry heard that breaches in security at two hotels allowed infected passengers to spread the disease into the community, causing a second wave of COVID-19. Instead of using soldiers to secure the hotels, like in other parts of the country, Victoria used private security guards. Many allegedly were poorly trained and ill-equipped. Victoria's Emergency Management Commissioner Andrew Crisp has told the investigating panel he thought private companies could do the job.
I guess in terms of a view, I thought they would have been a suitable and an appropriate workforce to use in the hotel. I've worked a lot with private security and the thinking was that well-trained, well-supervised private security in this type of role would have been efficient and effective.
They weren't. The hotel quarantine fiasco in Victoria is considered by many to be Australia's greatest failure in the pandemic so far. Senior government, police and health officials, including State Premier Daniel Andrews, are scheduled to give evidence before the inquiry. Victoria has accounted for about 75% of all confirmed COVID-19 cases across Australia and most of its fatalities. The state capital, Melbourne, is under some of the world's toughest coronavirus lockdowns until at least the end of the month. Restrictions, including a nighttime curfew, will only be eased when the rate of daily new infections falls to consistently lower levels. Authorities have said the trend is heading in the right direction. They are confident lockdown measures will be gradually eased before the end of November. Beyond Melbourne in regional Victoria, disease control directives will be eased significantly on Wednesday because infection rates have declined. Many personal freedoms, big and small, are being restored. Stay-at-home orders will no longer apply. People can sit in a restaurant to dine, and children's sports can resume. Limits, though, will still apply to social gatherings. Australia has had almost 27,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases, and more than 800 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Malaysia, the coronavirus pandemic has led to an increasing number of food deliveries and an increasing number of road accidents, as oftentimes reckless drivers break traffic laws to meet the rising demand. As Dave Grunbaum reports from Kuala Lumpur, the frequency of road accidents has raised questions about delivery rider safety.
Food delivery. It makes life easier for so many. Malaysia, like many countries, has seen an increase in demand for food delivery since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Most deliveries here are made by motorbike, but during the past 6 months, there has been a steady stream of headlines of accidents involving delivery riders. The Malaysian Institute of Road Safety Research recently conducted a 4-day study of 11 intersections. It observed almost 3,500 motorbike delivery riders and found that about 2/3 did not obey the rules of the road, and about 1/3 committed a serious safety violation, including holding their phones in their hands, running red lights, making illegal U-turns, and going in the wrong direction. Khairul Anwar, the Road Safety Institute's Director General, says these dangerous maneuvers happen all too often.
It is like a norm for food delivery riders in Malaysia to behave this way because of their work demand and their determination to meet target of the day.
The food delivery riders are typically freelancers who own their own motorbikes. The more deliveries they make, the more money they earn.
The system gives them incentive to speed or to potentially run red lights. Is that part of the problem?
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes.
Emeril Rashid has been delivering food for about a year. He acknowledges that many delivery riders are not careful enough, but he also says the riders often feel pressure to hurry their deliveries.
Okay, pressure itu biasa datang daripada customer.
He says the pressure usually comes from the customers because usually the customers want their orders fast. The two biggest food delivery companies are Grab and Foodpanda, both of which declined our request for an interview. But Cairo Anwar of the Road Safety Institute called their current safety training inadequate, adding that these companies need to do more to promote a work culture that stresses safety.
So we have to embed the safety things into this motorcyclist's mind. They have to be, it's not only about delivering the products, it must safely, safe attitude per se, safe behavior.
The Institute says it's developing a road safety training program and talking with both companies about it. Emeril Rashid and other delivery riders told VOA they support the plan. But the riders acknowledge that no matter how much training they get, it's ultimately up to them to always emphasize safety over speed. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Kuala Lumpur.
Johns Hopkins University in the United States reports there have been 29.6 million cases of COVID-19 worldwide, with nearly 950,000 deaths. That's it for our show today. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow morning for more International Edition with Steve Miller. That show will be broadcast and rebroadcast at 3:30, 4:30, 5:30, and 6:30 a.m. in Dakar, 4:30, 5:30, 6:30, and 7:30 a.m. in Kinshasa, 5:30, 6:30, 7:30, and 8:30 a.m. Johannesburg time, and 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, and 9:30 a.m. Nairobi time. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The political turmoil in Belarus since the fraudulent re-election of authoritarian Alexander Lukashenko on August 9th continues. Members of the political opposition in Belarus set up the National Coordination Council, or NCC, to negotiate with the Belarusian authorities about holding free and fair elections and a transition of power. Instead of engaging in good faith, the Lukashenko regime has launched a politically motivated investigation against the National Coordination Council and detained, forced into exile, and abducted members of the NCC. Indeed, the United States is deeply concerned by the September 7th abduction of National Coordination Council member Maria Kolesnikova in Minsk and the forced expulsions of spokesman Anton Rodenko and Executive Secretary Ivan Krautsu on September 8th. Maxim Znak, also a National Coordination Council member, was detained the following day. The United States commends the courage of Ms. Kolesnikova and of the Belarusian people in peacefully asserting their right to pick their leaders in free and fair elections. Protesters have faced brute violence and repression by government authorities, which included brazen beatings in broad daylight and thousands of detentions, as well as increasing reports of abductions. Since September 1st, university students have been the victims of violent crackdowns led by security forces dressed in black with their faces covered in ski masks. Several were picked up from the street and thrown into unmarked minivans. The United States, in coordination with its partners and allies, is considering additional targeted sanctions to promote accountability for those involved in human rights abuses and repression in Belarus. We remind the Belarusian authorities of their responsibility to ensure the safety of Ms. Kolesnikova and all those unjustly detained, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. We call on the Belarusian authorities to end the violence against their own people. Release all those who have been unjustly detained, including U.S. citizen Vitaly Shkliarov, and engage in meaningful dialogue with genuine representatives of Belarusian society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.